ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And you could be the most successful business person on earth, and if you are lonely and you don't have any close friends and your kids don't want to talk to you, you're miserable.
You might think success is a big title and a big salary, but there's one thing that stands above the rest when it comes to your health and happiness, and that is connecting with people.
And the way that we often do that is through conversations. And so knowing how to have good conversations is something that helps us live longer. We are social creatures. We find meaning and happiness from connecting with other people.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and I'm sitting down with Charles Duhigg to hear how we can communicate better in our life and our career. Charles is a reporter at New Yorker magazine and an author. His latest book is Super Communicators: How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. In this episode of This Working Life, he's sharing his top tips on how you can become a super communicator. And we got Charles to answer some of your questions as well. And you didn't disappoint with your super tricky questions.
I can honestly say this is a question that I've never encountered before. So it's very interesting for me.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. Charles, what makes someone a super communicator in the first place?
All of us are super communicators at one time or another, right? All of us have the ability, when a friend calls, to know what to say, to know what question to ask, or to walk into a meeting and know exactly what to say to get everyone on board with our idea. But there are some people who can do this consistently. Some people who can connect with almost anyone, who can be a super communicator anytime they decide that they need that or want that. And what we know is that it's just the set of skills that they've learned. They oftentimes are thinking just half an inch deeper about communication, and that's what makes them better at it.
You spoke to a wide range of people for your book: CIA recruiters, NASA, psychologists, and various researchers. What did you find was the thing that drew them all together? Was there anything there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a handful of skills that are really critical. And I'll mention one thing that's really interesting is that if you talk to the best communicators and you ask them, have you always been good at communication? They often say no. They often say something like, you know, when I was in high school, I had trouble making friends. And so I really had to study how kids talk to each other. Or my parents got divorced and I was the peacemaker between them. And it's that crucible of having to think a little bit more about communication that makes us better at communication. And one of the real skills that we know super communicators have is that they ask more questions. In fact, they ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person. And some of those questions are questions just to invite you in, like, you know, oh, what'd you say next? Or, oh, what'd you think about that? But some of them are what are known as deep questions. And a deep question is something that asks about our values or beliefs or experiences. And that can sound kind of intimidating, but it's as simple as if you bump into someone who's a doctor, instead of saying, oh, what hospital do you work at? Saying, oh, you know, what made you decide to go to medical school? What do you like about being a doctor? Do you love it? When we ask those questions, we're inviting someone to tell us something meaningful about themselves. And that can be really powerful.
So, Charles, you say that in many ways you wrote this book for yourself because you were reflecting on some of your own failures at communicating when you were managing a complex work project. So I want to go to that moment when your colleague came to you. They shared that they felt that their suggestions were being ignored, their contributions unrecognized. How did you respond at the time?
Well, what I did is I tried to solve their problem immediately, right? They walked in, and what they really wanted is they wanted empathy. They wanted me to recognize what's happening here and to let them know that they were right, that they weren't being gaslit. But instead of doing all of that, instead of having an emotional conversation with them, what I did is I jumped right into a practical conversation. And I said, okay, so here's how we're going to solve the problem. We're going to let you set the agenda, and you're going to get a new title. And this went on for a couple of minutes, and then they said, look, you're not actually listening to me. Like, I didn't come in here asking you for solutions. I didn't come in here asking for a new title. I came in here to tell you how I felt in these meetings. And it was at that moment that I realized I'm making a mistake here, right? I'm a professional communicator. I'm a journalist. And yet when this person tried to communicate with me, I failed to hear what they needed and wanted entirely.
And that critical moment sort of set you on this investigation into communication. But you also say that when you're communicating with someone, really it's about connection with them. Can you go deeper on what you mean by connection there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're living through a golden age of understanding the neurology of communication like never before. And one of the things that we've learned is that when we're talking to each other, like in this conversation, not only do our bodies start to match each other, our breathing patterns will start to align, our heart rates will become similar, but the thoughts within our heads, our neural activity begins to look more and more similar. And that makes sense when you think about it, because if I tell you about an emotion I was feeling or an idea that I had, the reason that's effective is because you feel that emotion a little bit. You experience that idea. And so it makes sense that our brains would become what in the language of neuroscience is known as neurally entrained. And once we become neurally entrained, that's when we feel a sense of connection. In fact, our brains have evolved to crave that kind of connection. That's why when you have a conversation, it feels wonderful, is because you achieve this entrainment and it's something that we've evolved to want.
And I love this concept because there's that felt sense when you start talking to someone. Dr. Dan Siegel, the clinical psychologist, calls it that attunement. It's like you've kind of got to tune into someone's wavelength, don't you? And then you start resonating with them. So I feel like it really captures that moment of feeling heard.
Absolutely. And this is reflected in our language, right? We talk about clicking with someone. We talk about getting on the same wavelength. When we talk about understanding with someone or having a great conversation, we talk about connection. And when I started working on this book, I figured that there were some people who could do this better than others and that they were probably extroverts or they were incredibly charming. But what the research says is exactly the opposite, that some super communicators are extroverts and some are introverts. Some are charming, some are curmudgeonly. It's just a set of skills that literally anyone can learn. And once we learn those skills and we practice them and then we make them into habits, that's when all of a sudden we can connect with anyone.
We'll get to those skills soon. Charles will detail them in his answers to your questions shortly. But there's one thing he says is critical in being a super communicator, and that's going a bit meta and figuring out what kind of conversation is happening.
Yeah, it gets to the same issue that I had with my direct reports, right? The employee that I was talking to. So one of the things that we know is that we tend to think of a discussion as being about one topic. We're talking about today's agenda or where we should go on vacation or what we're going to do about our kids' grades. But what research has told us is that underneath that one discussion is actually many kinds of conversations. And these different kinds of conversations, they tend to fall into one of three buckets. There's practical conversations where we're solving problems, we're making plans together. But then there's also emotional conversations. And I might tell you how I'm feeling, and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other and society and the social identities that are important to us. And what's interesting is that each of those different kinds of conversations uses a different part of our brain. And so, as I mentioned before, one of the things that we try to do in a conversation is we try to become neurally entrained. We try to think alike. Now, if I'm having an emotional conversation and I'm telling my wife about how terrible my day is, and she responds with a practical conversation, she says, "Why don't you take your boss out to lunch? You guys can get to know each other." I won't be able to hear her. I'll say something like, "You know, why aren't you on my side? Why aren't you supporting me? You're supposed to be outraged on my behalf." And then she'll get upset because I'm attacking her for giving me good advice. The key is what's known within psychology as the matching principle. You have to be having the same kind of conversation at the same moment in order to align. And then once you do that, you can move from emotional to practical to social and back to emotional together. But it's that alignment that's critical.
So let's go now to one of the questions from our This Working Lifers. Let's go with Larissa Garcia.
I'm a coach and facilitator working in the areas of leadership and culture. Charles, I have a question for you. How could I lead a conversation towards an emotional one when it's become too practical, or vice versa, being able to transition a conversation away from an emotional exchange to get it to become more practical?
The best thing that we can do is ask permission. This example that I use with my wife when I come home and complain about my day, it's not theoretical, right? It's something that was happening all the time. And one of the things that we did is we got into this pattern now where when I come home and I start complaining about my day, my wife will ask me, "Look, is this something that you want to solve? Like, should we talk about solutions? Or do you just need to complain and get this off your chest? Do you just want to vent?" And of course, it feels really good to have someone ask that because sometimes I don't know myself until I'm asked. And so one of the things we can do is we can ask permission or ask what kind of conversation someone is seeking. In schools, they teach teachers that when a student comes up with a problem, to ask them, do you want to be helped? Do you want to be hugged? Or do you want to be heard? And those are the three kinds of conversations. When we're doing that, what we're doing is we're asking the person, what do you need right now? But then we can also ask permission to change, right? So I complain about my day for a little while, and then my wife says, I totally hear what you're saying. Is it okay? Could we talk about solutions now? Because I feel like I have some ideas on what to do. And oftentimes, if you present that transition as something that you're asking the other person to buy into, they're willing to go there with you. And so I think that's the first principle, is have a meta conversation, have a conversation about why you're talking to each other and what you hope to get out of this. And that's going to help you transition together.
And Charles, this is a skill you call matching. So how do we match without feeling like we're mirroring someone and feeling a bit fake?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's important to note that there's a difference between mimicry and matching, right? So we've all been in a conversation where we cross our arms and then the other person crosses their arms, and we ask a question about the weather and then they ask a question about the weather. And we know that that's not genuine, right? We know it's not authentic. That's mimicry, but matching is authentic. Matching is saying, I want to connect with you in a genuine way. Let me show you that I want to connect. So it might very well be that you mentioned something that your aunt has recently passed away. And to match you, I don't have to talk about my own aunt. I might just ask you a question and say, I know how hard that can be. Like, what was your aunt like? How are you doing? Right? That's matching the kind of conversation you're having. In a workplace, I think this happens a lot, that you're waiting for a meeting and you're in the conference room and you're sort of just chatting with the person next to you. And you ask them, what did you do this weekend? And they say something like, oh, I went to my son's graduation. It was great. And the most natural thing is to say, oh, congratulations. Okay, let's get down to business. Here's the agenda. But the best thing that you can do is to try and match that person by saying, oh man, a graduation. Like, how did you feel watching him walk across that stage? Because I have kids of my own, and I'm proud of them, but I'm also worried about them leaving home. I'm going to miss them so much. I'm just wondering, like, what was that experience like for you? What's happening there is that someone said, I went to my kid's graduation, which is an invitation to talk about something that's a little bit more emotional. And when we match them by saying, I want to hear about how you feel, then we're creating an opportunity for us to share something meaningful. And that's how we connect.
Okay, let's go to another This Working Lifer now, who's got a really tricky conversation that she wants to bounce off you. It's Louise Thompson.
Charles, I have a question which is tricky. It's uncomfortable for many to address. And a lot of team leaders ask me for their advice around how do you raise the subject of personal hygiene, in particular when many team members complain to their team leader about a specific team member who has body odor. They don't know how to raise it. They skirt around the issue. And how do you raise that conversation with the person that has the body odor?
I can honestly say this is a question that I've never encountered before. So it's very interesting for me. A lot of this is contingent on what's your relationship like with this person, right? If you have a personal relationship with them, then it's going to be much easier for you to say, look, I'd like to have a private conversation. But in general, this is what we know about having hard conversations. Hard conversations often make us anxious and concerned because we anticipate that they're going to go worse than they actually are. We avoid conversations that we think are going to be hard because we don't know what we're going to say, and we don't know what the other person is going to say, and we don't know how they're going to react. And so one of the best things that we can do is we can try and remove that anxiety and remove that uncertainty by starting a conversation by saying, look, I want to talk about something and it's a little bit awkward. And I want to apologize in advance. I'm probably going to say the wrong thing at some point, and I hope that you'll forgive me. And by the same token, if you say the wrong thing, I want you to know I will absolutely forgive you. And let me tell you why I want to do this. It's because I care about you so much. I care about your success in this workplace. I want us to solve a problem together that allows you to be as successful as you can be. Now, that doesn't mean that when I next say, you know, you have to start using deodorant, that person's going to love hearing that, right? But because I have prefaced it by saying, this is awkward, I've removed some of the awkwardness from our concerns. And secondarily, I've told you what my goal is, what my intent is. My intent is not to offend you. My intent is not to make you feel bad. My intent is to help you succeed. And that's not going to make it easy to hear that news, but it's going to make it easier. And there's a lot of hard conversations that we can have where this kind of principle helps us.
All right, this is our third and final one. This one's from Tanmay Vora.
My question for Charles is, how do we build the bridge of communication with someone who is not intentionally aligned with the purpose of team or organization? Thank you.
It's a great question. And let me just say that knowing how to be a super communicator, that does not mean that you can solve all problems overnight, right? If you've got an employee who basically does not want to be an employee, that they don't agree with the organization, they don't get aligned, it's hard. It's hard to use conversation to get them on board, but we can try. And one of the most important things that we can do is that we can show them that we're listening to them. You know, when we're in a conversation that's a little bit tense, when we disagree with each other, when I'm telling you, like, I need you to perform in a different way, I need you to get on board with this mission, and it doesn't seem like you want to, there's this sneaking suspicion in our head, in everyone's head, that the other person isn't listening to them. They're just waiting their turn to speak. And so the best thing that we can do is we can prove that we're listening. And there's a really good technique for this that they teach in colleges and universities and law schools. And it's known as looping for understanding. And it has these three steps. This first step is you should ask a question, right? If you're talking to an employee who seems resistant, start by asking a question, preferably a deep question, something like, tell me what this job means to you. Tell me what you like and you don't like about this job. How does it fit into your life? And then listen to them. And when they're done responding, summarize in your own words what they just said. And it's important that you're proving to them not only you paid attention, but that you're processing. Oh, what I hear you say is that this job for you is about providing for your family, but you're not really passionate about the product that we're making. It's much more important to you to try and have a steady paycheck. And then the third step, which is ask if you got it right. Am I hearing you correctly? And one of two things is going to happen. Either the person is going to say, actually, no, like I'm saying something else a little bit different, and which is useful, right? Now I understand why you're not motivated, is because I was assuming that you hated this product. And actually what you're telling me is that you have a sick kid and it's distracting at home. Or maybe they'll say, yeah, you did hear me correctly. In which case, what I'm actually doing is I'm asking you for permission to acknowledge that I've been listening. And when I prove that I'm listening to you, you become much more likely to listen to me in return. And so my guess is that for that employee, no employee wants to be doing a bad job. No employee wants to be unmotivated at work. But there's something going on there that's making it hard for them. In many cases, in many managerial cases, the key is to really understand how the other person sees the world. Right, we all carry stories inside our heads that explain to us why our behavior makes sense, or that helps us understand the world. And you and I, we don't have precisely the same story in our head. And if we're having tension, we probably have different stories in our head. And until we understand each other's stories, it's very, very hard for us to connect and to move forward. And so the first thing to do is to simply ask, what's going on with you? How do you see the world? How do you see this job? Let me prove to you that I'm listening. And in doing so, hopefully you'll be more likely to listen to the story I'm carrying around, and we can find some way to move forward.
Charles, I often say, you know, I'm the hero of my story and you're the hero of your story, right? So, and that's how we build out our stories. It takes one of us to go first in a way, though, to be curious enough about the other person's story and to even seek to understand it. So is that fair that, you know, there's this obligation on the super communicator to go first?
Well, I don't know that it's an obligation on the super communicator. I think it's the obligation on the leader. Right? When I'm made a manager, or I'm made the head of this team, or I'm made a leader, where I'm really promising is not necessarily I'm going to make all the decisions for everyone. I'm promising I'm going to do my best to take care of everyone, to help them become their best self at work. And if you're good at communication, that you don't have any obligation to communicate. You don't, not everything has to be a conversation. Sometimes you get in the Uber and you just want to check your email, right? Or sometimes I tell my kids, I want to have a conversation about your rooms. And I don't actually want to have a conversation about their rooms. I just want them to clean their rooms. But the point is that having these skills and these tools available to you, when you do want to communicate, when you do want to connect, when you are a leader and it is your job to connect with your employees, that's critical.
So I have a theory, Charles, that we don't perhaps prepare enough for conversations.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right, right? And for most conversations, we don't have to prepare. But one of the things that we know is that when we do prepare, particularly for hard conversations, it helps us immeasurably. There was an experiment that was done by researchers at Harvard Business School where they told a class full of students, okay, in about 2 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, you're going to have a conversation with a stranger. And having a conversation with a stranger is one of the most anxiety-producing things we can ask people to do. And they said, but before you have this conversation, take just 7 or 10 seconds, and I want you to write down 3 topics you might discuss. And they were dumb topics. It was like, did you see the movie last night? Are you going to the party this weekend? But everyone took 7 seconds and they scribbled down 3 topics and then they stuck their cards in their pockets. And then they went and they had the conversations. And afterwards, the researchers asked, did those topics come up? And the participants said, no, you know, actually, the topics we wrote down, they never came up. But I felt so much more confident. I felt so much less anxiety in this conversation because I knew that if we hit an awkward silence or if I run out of things to say, I've already got 3 things in my pocket that I can talk about or I can ask questions about. And I think that there's a lesson there, which is when we get anxious about a conversation, when the conversation gets awkward, it's because we're uncertain of what comes next. The same thing is true. There's a lot of anxiety about how to end conversations. And some research has been done on this. And I'll tell folks the perfect way to end a conversation, which is to say to someone, say you're at a party, to say, oh, you know, I need to go freshen my drink. But before I do, let me ask you one more question. And then whatever question you ask, they're going to answer it in about 15 seconds. Because what you're really saying is, will you give me permission for both of us to acknowledge that we need to go talk to other people, that we can't talk to each other all night long? And so a lot of this is about signaling to the other person that we care about them, that we want to connect with them, that we're trying to think of their feelings and accommodate that. When we do that, conversations become much easier. And oftentimes, a key to that is preparation, just thinking 7 to 10 seconds before you pick up the phone or open your mouth what you actually want to say.
We mentioned about the preparing for a conversation. I think another area where we're potentially underdone is reflecting on how we went on a conversation. So we often write down notes about the content, but do we reflect on how we went about that conversation? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting you ask this because one of the things that we know from research is that if you ask someone to recall a conversation they had about a week ago and you ask them, what did you discuss and what did people say? They might remember one of the topics, right? Maybe two, but they're not going to remember what the specific words that anyone said, and they're not going to remember who said what. But then if you ask them, how did you feel in that conversation? They will be able to tell you precisely how they felt throughout the conversation. One of the things that we tend to do is after a conversation, we tend to look at the content and evaluate, did I get across the thing that was important to me? But we don't spend as much time saying, did I make the other people feel the way that I was hoping that they would feel? Did I ask the right questions to understand what was important to the other people in this discussion? Not necessarily did I get my ideas across, but did I hear their ideas? It doesn't mean that we have to do that every single time, right? And it doesn't mean that we're beholden to other people's whims or desires, but it means that we have the tools to analyze whether a conversation went as we hoped it would or didn't. And if it didn't, we know how to change for the next time and get better at it.
Thank you so much, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Duhigg, reporter for New Yorker magazine and author of Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. In our next episode, we're exploring what does it mean to have an ethical career and what happens when our job isn't aligned with our ethics anymore. Don't miss it. Make sure you're following the podcast to get the latest episodes. This Working Life is produced by Zoe Ferguson, mixed by Kerry Dell. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.